Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240 for Autumn Semester 2021.
Today, the Federal Reserve and economic policy 1960 to 1980. Before we do that, just a quick look through the numbers to see what's going on. And let me make sure I'm all set to go here. And of course, this lecture that's coming today is not in the textbook. You do have the supplemental materials and the resources, but be sure that you take tight notes on it. Now, a very quick look at the numbers to begin this story for the day on Wall Street. As you can see, it is just an absolute flat day. There's nothing to write home about. There's a certain degree to which there's a dullness to the markets. There's not an enthusiasm. Does that mean that we're on the brink of a black swan? No, it does not mean that. Actually, the numbers going into the Christmas holiday season seem to be pretty strong. So we're not in a terrible situation yet. But as you can see, just flat down, negatives. All of them were negatives, but just tiny negatives. Crude had slipped below 80, and boy, there was a real hard rally to pull it back up above 80. It's still on its way up, but it's not a major problem. Notice even the metals are lackluster today. Now, the 10-year bond went up. The yield was up 4 basis points, which means that the price had gone down. So there was a sell-off in bonds. There was a sell-off in equities. Well, a little bit of sell-off. So where in the heck did all this money go? Well, probably it went into money markets, essentially cash. And it's almost like a wait-and-see attitude right now in the markets. And that's what I'm getting from traders, too, is who knows what's going to happen next. We need a direction, something to tell us. Now, as you can see, the London was about the same way, just pretty much flat. Japan was up kind of a fairly decent amount, but things are different over there than they are here right now. So can't take any reading from today. It's just kind of one of those dead days on the street. Enough of that. I got a graphic to show you later, but it's on your RegiNet as well. Now, the story of central banks. In Europe, there were the beginnings of central banks, a bank that was the government's bank, as far back as the Renaissance, in some parts of Europe. It was sort of understood that there needed to be a central controlling bank that managed the money supply and managed banking in general, that was part of the government, that had experts in it, unlike the government itself, where the politicians were sort of in charge. The central bank would be bankers, money people, knowledgeable about the world of business and finance and economics, even that far back in time. And by the time we get to 1700s, some of those sort of central banks were legitimately legal central banks. So Europe spearheaded that whole affair. In Asia, there were conceptual frameworks that were similar to central banks as well. In the United States, the talk of a central bank was just not something that was popular. You always, whenever it was brought up in the early years of the country, you would have these rabble-rousers saying, it's government interference. We're free. We're a free people. We don't need no government to have a bank. And every time they brought it up, nope. In fact, at one point, a national bank was established, which collapsed under political pressure. And then you got a second version of it, a national bank, that got on its feet and was doing well with deposits from well-to-do people. And here came old President Andrew Jackson, the asshole that he was, the genocidal murderer that he was, and the overall, I'm a populist, see, I don't care about intellectual people and the rich, I'm for the people kind of guy. And he actually sent the federal troops to that second national bank, and they raided it, they seized all the money from it. So that was the end of that little try. And there wasn't really anything else that came close to it. There was talk that the banks were out of hand. Especially after the Civil War, the idea of banks was obviously there. Banks were around. But some of them were, I mean, banks were just as phony could get. And so there were these sod banks, as they called them, that were there for a few years or a few months in some town, and then they just went belly up, and you never saw the owners of the bank again because they had left town with their gold. And so the currency that they printed against that gold, just so much for the gold standard being everything you would want it to be. So, but then you get into the 1880s, and it was, I mean, the corruption, the scams, the con games were just, oh, unbelievable. And when banks, you see, here's the thing about banks, is that when you put money in a bank, the bank isn't going to keep all of your money. It's going to lend some of it out in order to make money as a bank. That's how it does it. So you have an initial reserve of, let's say, okay, the money supply in the bank, reserve, lendable. So if you start with a base amount of, let's say, M0, $1,000. Say the bank holds 20% of that in reserve. Well, that would mean that there are $200 held in reserve and then $800 to lend out. Well, someone lends that out, that comes back to the bank as another deposit. And so, what, 20% of $160 and then the remainder, $740, is lent out. And the cycle continues. So you have a growth of the money supply by the natural mechanism of the growth of the bank's reserves. Now, in a way, this looks kind of funny, phony. Wait a minute, there's money just being created by the money that was there before? Yes. But it works. And it has worked all through history. Even in the Middle Ages, this was the trick. Okay, the problem comes for when a bank doesn't keep any unreserved to give back to the people. You come in here, you deposit $800, you might like some of your money back. You write a check, or you come in to use the ATM, you'd like to have that money there. And so obviously this reserve is important for that. But if banks didn't keep very much, 10%, 5%, or something like that, well, this whole thing finally collapsed as soon as someone walked in the bank and said, I want my money, and it wasn't there because it had been lent out. So that was this bad thing that was happening in the late 1800s, was these banks were not controlled. There was no rule that they had to have a certain amount on reserve, a required reserve ratio. So they didn't. And so when a few people came into the bank, well, that was it. Or even a responsible bank. Suppose that you heard that there was a phony bank that had collapsed because it wasn't keeping reserves. Well, then everyone runs the bank that was being responsible, and they didn't have enough money for everyone to come in, and so that bank collapses.
And then people see that bank collapse and they run to their banks and those banks buckle. Even though they were doing okay, they kept reserves. They didn't have enough for everyone to run the bank. This was happening all over the place in that era. Whole cities were having their, like a house of cards, their banks were coming down because of one or two bad actors. And sometimes, as was the case later especially, you would have these very powerful people start a rumor that a bank didn't have enough money for its depositors. And so the depositors would freak out, go to the bank, and sure enough, they didn't, because everyone went there at once. And then, of course, the powerful rich who had started this would go in and buy up the bank for pennies on the dollar. All kinds of scams. But God, you try to stay a regulation or an agency to oversee it, and oh, here came the, oh, we can't have that, that's freedom, that's a restriction on our freedom, government intervention. By God, stop that. Well, you see, this was happening in a lot of different areas. The world was complex, and it was getting more complex. Notwithstanding what you hear about, this is a world no one's ever seen before, it's been getting that way for centuries. And every generation has talked about, my God, it's so much more complicated now. Well, in the late 1800s, yeah, it was getting complicated. You couldn't just say free markets, let the banks regulate themselves, and people should know better than to put their money in a bank without researching it, all that. They were also doing the same thing with monopolies. No one should regulate, we shouldn't regulate businesses, say how big they should grow, what they should do. But then, in the case of monopolies, it was when the government and the rich people started getting screwed by the monopolies that suddenly we started getting antitrust legislation, Sherman Act of 1890, and on and on. Well, it took about the first decade of the 20th century for the banking problems to get serious enough that the rich were getting screwed by these phony banks in this unregulated banking world. And so we had the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. The Federal Reserve Act of 1913. It created the Federal Reserve System. The country was divided into 12 districts that would each have 12 districts. So each one would have a district bank that oversaw the banks in that district. The Federal Reserve Board would be 12 governors. One of them would be the chairman. Now watch it on an exam. My favorite question to try to trick you is to say the Federal Reserve Board has 12 governors and one chairman. That's false. It has 12 governors. One of them is the chairman. Now these governors are historically the cream of the crop. Just consummate finance professionals, good people. Always, of course, until recent years, it was all the usual Caucasian male old men. But that's changed recently. But the thing was that they were really strong intellectually. They were moderates. They were not crazies. They weren't, by today's standards, you would call them hard conservatives. But normally, in the times of them, they were the moderates. They didn't fall for progressive leftist. They didn't go crazy right-wing extremist. They were, we manage the banking system of this country. That means we have to be the adults in the room at all times. And I, in my time, I met two of them in my time. And they were those kinds of professionals, you know that they knew what they were doing. And you didn't even bother to talk with them about, I didn't even feel like I was qualified to talk with them about banking. But now, these 12 governors are appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. They're appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. So they go through a vetting process. Unfortunately, in recent decades, the last two decades, we've had some much weaker governors and chairmen. I don't know how to put this, but the appointees by the last three presidents, Bush, Obama, and Trump, were in several cases just almost like, this is not what a governor should be, kinds of people. But politics and all of that kind of intervened. But the bottom line was that these board governors, they regulate the banking system. They take the laws of Congress and they interpret them into actionable policies to be applied to banks. Again, they regulate. The Board of Governors regulates. They take the laws and they interpret them for action by banks. That's the way regulatory agencies always do. Look, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, its job is to take the laws, environmental laws, and create regulations that businesses can follow. So that's what agencies do. It's actually kind of more of a modern thing. The Federal Reserve was one of the first agencies that did things that way. There was one also for antitrust law when the Federal Trade Commission was created to enforce antitrust laws. There was one in the 1860s, was it? The Railroad Commission. But you see this idea of instead of having a law, thou shalt not, and hoping that prosecutors and sheriffs or whatever would enforce the laws, that gave way to this idea of agency, experts who would take the laws, interpret them for the targets of the laws, and then you would have a much more efficient system that way. So the Federal Reserve Board of Governors regulates the banking system. The district bank presidents then supervise. So regulation is from the board, supervision is from the district banks. So in other words, here where we are, we're actually almost right between the Chicago Fed and the St. Louis Fed. We're in the Chicago. So the Federal Reserve Board, the Chicago District Bank regulates the banks right around this area and all through the north part. Now, there are 12 district banks, so this is going on. Oddly enough, well, interestingly enough, when this was all created back in 1913, there weren't very many people on the west side of the United States, so the districts out there were huge, and the districts on the East Coast were tiny. And unfortunately, that means now that everyone lives out west, you've got the San Francisco District Bank and some of those just up to their eyeballs in work to regulate all the banks out there. But as a matter of fact, I'm just going to pull one out. What is that letter there you see in the circle?
A.
A. And what does that say? What is A?
Federal Reserve of... Boston, Massachusetts.
Boston. And if you look, each one of these, the minting stamp will tell you which Federal Reserve printed this Federal Reserve note. Now, the Federal Reserve historically had three jobs, three duties. It was charged under the law with three responsibilities. The first one was to regulate and supervise the banking system. Get the banks under frickin' control. The second was odd. The Federal Reserve acts as a bank for banks. Now, banks need a place to do their banking. So the Federal Reserve says, you can deposit your money here. You can write checks off us. But you see, the rule was that the Federal Reserve could serve as a bank for banks, but they could not do so in such a way that they destroyed the private commercial banks for banks. In other words, we have banks for banks that are just regular, like banks, but they're for banks. They're huge animals. And the Federal Reserve does it too. Now, the Federal Reserve is required under the law, first of all, to not use predatory pricing. In other words, you can't undercut the private commercial banks on bank fees for banks. And also, the Federal Reserve must always be spending gads of money on new technologies. And then it must share those for free with its private competitors. This is why we have things like those magnetic ink strips down there at the bottom of your checks, you know, the magnetic ink codes. They did that, had these ATMs, these high-speed things. That was Federal Reserve development, and then it's shared by all the banks. It's given to all the banks in the country that are commercial banks for banks. And then when the Federal Reserve makes a profit off what it does, that all goes to the Treasury. And every year, the Federal Reserve, through its bank-for-bank operations, sends checks of billions of dollars. The Federal Reserve is one of the good guys, kind of. Someone asked me, I've given this lecture for years. It was back in the 2000s sometime. One student asked this, well, what's the percentage of banks that do, you know, the Federal Reserve and the percentage that use private commercial banks? I didn't know, so I called some people I know down at the St. Louis Fed, and they said, actually, in our district, 65% of banks use the Fed, 35% use private commercial banks. And they both thrive in this system. They both thrive. The commercial banks for banks make massive profits. They do fine. I tried to bring this up some years back when the whole healthcare insurance thing blew up during the Obama administration early on. And I said, why can't we create a health insurance system that's like our Fed? You have the government provide health insurance in such a way that it is in competition with, but it will not destroy the private healthcare insurers. Oh, God, that was not going to be acceptable. No insurance or, you know, communist insurance, whatever, I don't know, socialist insurance. No one wanted to think about this incredible system that's been working for about a century. It works. The government's provision of the service does not destroy the private sector. The technological innovations have been just delicious all along. Oh, God forbid we should have an idea like that somewhere in the middle of the fight. Okay, three. The Federal Reserve conducts monetary policy. In other words, it controls the money supply. Now, the Fed's job was to maintain the stability of the aggregate price level. To maintain the stability of the aggregate price level.
That's a fancy way of saying no inflations, no deflations, none of that. In other words, depoliticize monetary policy. Don't print money when there's a recession. Don't drag money out of the economy if it's burning too hot. You hold it straight, and then we won't have inflation. If the real growth rate of the economy is matching the real growth rate of the money supply, you won't have inflation or deflation. It doesn't happen. No amount of blathering about inflation is caused by higher union wages or minimum wage going up, or inflation is caused by rip-off corporations. Bullshit. It is not. It is the only thing that creates inflation is too much money being printed against the speed of the economy's growth. Or the alternative is if you drag the money supply's growth rate down too much, the economy can buckle and you could get a horrible thing called deflation. You remember that, because that's the key to what is happening now. Unfortunately, our blessed Congress in the 1970s got the idea that the Federal Reserve must use monetary policy to help the economy when it's in trouble. And that became exactly contrary to the third mandate. You couldn't have them both, and you couldn't talk to the senators at the time, don't do this, for God's sake. You can't say print money when we need the economy goosed and at the same time say don't let any inflation happen. Well, they don't work together that way. Yeah, pour more coal in when the house is a little chilly, but please don't let the house burn down. Well, gee. Okay, anyway. Now, in monetary policy, conducting it, it has three tools of monetary policy. The first one is a meat axe. It can actually modify the required reserve ratio. Let me show you. See this progression of money growing? There's actually a formula for it. The change in the money supply is going to be the base money that starts it times 1 over the required reserve ratio. This is called the money multiplier. So you see, if you raise 20% to 30%, that would slow down the money supply's growth. If you lower that reserve ratio, it would speed up the money's growth. Now, like I said, this is a blunt force. You would not see this being modified much at all. Now, if there were a true worry about the stability of the banking system and a fear that people were going to run the banks, you would probably see the Fed jack this up. As a matter of fact, I believe they did right after the attacks of September 11th, 2001, because there was a great deal of fear that the banks were going to get run by people panicking. They didn't, interestingly enough. Thank goodness for American resilience. But someone asked me, well, what is the required reserve ratio now? This was 10 years ago. I didn't know. I teach it. How am I supposed to know that? No, seriously, I mean, I was embarrassed because I did not know what it was, and I should be teaching this. So I made a rapid call to my friends down in St. Louis, and I said, what's the required reserve ratio? And I got an answer that I did not see it coming. The guy I talked to, he said, which one? Wait, what? Which one? What do you mean, which one? You know, was it 10, 20, 12.325? He said, no. You see, they measure money in tranches, T-R-A-N-C-H-E-S. In other words, he said, well, the first $10 million tranche of a bank's assets, the required reserve ratio is zero. Then for the next 50,000 or 50 million or something like that, it goes up to, I think he said, like 3.25%. And then for all tranche above that second tier, it's 5 point something. So in other words, it's not a single number. And I said, are you telling me that if a really small bank does not have a required reserve? He said, well, technically, no. No, dude. Does it or doesn't? No. But they usually keep one. Usually, you mean I can't write a bank? If I wrote a check on a tiny community bank, they might not have the money. He said, well, of course they'll have the money. But they don't have to. The idea there is that with small banks, their job is to be a real strong participant in the growth of a community. People having owner-occupied housing, businesses having loans. So they want to have the maximum amount of money available for those banks to lend out. Hence the zero required reserve ratio. That just knocked me dead. I don't know if it's still there, but my goodness. So it's not a simple thing. But anyway, that's a meat axe of a tool. The second one that the Fed can use is the discount rate. Now, banks need money. Like, for example, suppose you didn't have one night, your bank didn't have its required reserve ratio. Then it would have to borrow that money. Now, it can do that two ways. It could borrow it from other banks. That's essentially a supply and demand framework. That's called the Federal Reserve Pool. The Federal Funds Pool. So, banks, there is this giant pool of all the money from banks. It's called the Federal Funds Pool. These are federal funds. The word federal there is kind of, I never understood that because it's not federal. As a matter of fact, the federal government does not regulate this. Is driven by supply and demand dynamics. So the interest rate that a bank would be charged could be about, you know, if the supply of money in the pool is low, then the bank could borrow at a very high rate. That rate is called the federal funds rate. Fed funds rate. It is not set by the Fed. Now, the Fed can try to manipulate it by adding money to it or pulling money out of it through open market operations, but it's essentially a free market rate. And interestingly enough, it is the government can actually lend the money itself at the discount window. The Fed can lend money to banks. Now, the Fed will set this discount rate low or high based upon its desire to control inflation. Now, the discount rate historically has been lower than the Fed funds rate. Yet, historically, banks have gone to the federal funds pool to borrow, interbank lending. Historically, banks didn't go to the discount window, even though the rate was lower there. The Fed would lend them money at a rate lower than other banks would. And yet banks would go to the federal funds market much more likely. Why would they do that? Why would banks borrow from other banks at a higher rate than they could borrow from the Fed itself? Well, it's kind of one of those things where suppose that I needed $1,000 real fast. I could get it from my friends who would charge me a lot of interest, or I could get it from my dad for free. You know what the problem, though, is if you get it from your dad for free, he's going to ask you a whole hell of a lot of questions. What the hell do you mean? So that's a little bit of it. It's more like, well, you know, let's not poke the bear over here. We'll just borrow it in the interbank lending market. But this discount rate has become hugely popular for banks now because basically, the Fed is lending money out free. It has been since, during the crash after 2008, the Fed was handing out money like candy to banks. And of course, the recession kept going and the credit crisis did not let up, because what were these banks doing? They weren't freeing that money and lending it out to people and to businesses to recover from the great crash of 2008. They were investing it overseas. They were borrowing the money for free from the Fed and then cranking out money profits for themselves. So that was a bad thing. And then here we are again in about the same position with all of these banks still taking welfare to the tune of literally trillions of dollars from the Fed. And yet, oh boy, it's really hard to lend money, you know. Maybe you ought to have the government write you a check for COVID, but we can't really help you here. We're just going to charge you banking fees. Interestingly enough, I'll get into that later. And then there's the third one, the one that happens every day, day in and day out, to the tune of hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars every day. And almost no one has any clue that this is going on every day. They're called open market operations. Open market operations. You see, banks have to have safe capital in their vault. That can be dollars or it can be T-bills. They're both equally safe and equally tradable. The only difference is that dollars can be lent to people and businesses, T-bills can't. But either one of them, a bank needs to have. And these dollars, of course, are part of the Fed funds pool. So what the Fed does, day in and day out, is it manages. You're a desk trader at the Fed. In your desk are dollars and T-bills. The desk manager, when I say desk, I'm talking about hundreds of traders. This desk manager says drain liquidity. In other words, you've got to get money from those banks. So what you do is you try to sell them T-bills to get those dollars away from them. As you sell the T-bills prices go down and the rates go up. That's the draining of liquidity. Let me say it again. As you sell those T-bills to the banks, the price of T-bills goes down, and so their yields go up. That's how you drive up interest rates and drive liquidity out of the economy. Again, as the Fed desk sells those T-bills to the bank, that drives the price of T-bills down. Supply goes up, price goes down, and the consequence is that yields go up. So interest rates go up, and money is drained out of the economy. So the lendable funds, interest rates go through the roof. On the other hand, suppose that the desk manager says we have orders to add liquidity to the economy. What you would then do at that point is you would buy T-bills from the banks and add money. You would buy T-bills from the banks. As you bought the T-bills from the banks, the price of T-bills would go up and their yield would go down. So you would drive interest rates down and you would add money to the economy. That's what the Fed has been doing since 2017. Well, before that though. But they have just simply, every time the banks are going to go to the Treasury auctions. They're going to buy T-bills. And then they know damn well the Fed is going to call them the next day. Ring, ring, we'd like to buy those T-bills. Okay, here's some more money. So it's like a money engine the banks have been living on as money is poured into the economy through the open market operations over and over again, every day. And as the government borrows more and more money, well, those banks scurry over there to the
take care of that T-bill onslaught, T-note, T-bond onslaught. The government is printing out those treasury bills. So the Fed goes over there and buys a pile of them. And then the banks go over there and buy a pile of them. And then the Fed prints money and then calls the banks and says, we'd like to buy your T-bills. And so more money pours into the economy. And so essentially the gig goes on. It's not a side hustle. It's the main event. And then they have the gall to charge us for banking overdraft fees, for God's sake. Let's not be communists or socialists here, but let's be honest about it. Do you really think this could go on forever? And why are they pissing themselves? Oh, there's an inflation. My God, what is that? Well, guess what? You wanted it. 2017, the Fed could have stopped the growth rate of the economy, stopped the inflation, let us slide into a recession to get realigned and be stronger. We would have been out by 2018, 2019, ready to face COVID straight on. But no, the president threatened to fire the Fed chairman, which had never been done before, fired the Fed chairman. And so he peed himself and printed money. He said, crank it out. Now, the question is, how is this policy being decided? That there is a Federal Open Market Committee, FOMO, FOMO. And this has the seven governors and five district bank presidents. They make those calls. They decide, okay, what's the discount rate going to go? Which way, up or down, or stay the same? It's like a signaling mechanism to the markets. Well, the Fed raised the discount rate today. Well, that's saying the Fed is getting pissed off about inflation. However, you will see so many of these allegedly informed financial news networks say the Fed set the federal funds rate at, no, they didn't. They can't do that. They can't set it. It is a free market rate. They will set a target. They'll say, we want the federal funds rate to be 5.25%. And then they'll do open market operations, buying and selling, to get the rate to that, you know, draining or adding money to the Fed funds pool. But they can't set it. They can set a target, but they can't set it. They can set the discount rate. Watch it, because I can ask that on a quiz or a final exam. The federal funds rate is set by the Fed or something like that. Watch it. No, okay, now. The five district bank presidents, four of them serve two-year rotating terms. One of them is permanent. That would be the president of the New York Federal Reserve District Bank, the Empire Bank, we call it. Why is that position permanent? Because the open market desk, what's called the domestic trading desk, the DTD, the domestic trading desk, is at the New York Fed. And this is a huge operation. I mean, this is a big thing. You could be a trader, you'd live a great life, make money, live in New York City where you could get robbed, mugged every day when you went home from work. I mean, it's a great place. But the domestic trading desk, you see the FOMO, the FOMO, the Federal Open Market, FOMC, geez, Zooey, I'm sorry, FOMC, Federal Open Market Committee, it makes the decisions. We're going to add liquidity. Then it contacts, then the New York Bank president, who is at the FOMC meeting all the time, he or she would then call the desk at the bank, at the Empire Bank, say, add liquidity or drain liquidity. And then the desk manager calls the traders, like I was telling you earlier, and says, do it. The committee says, add liquidity. So that means that you're going to go out there and start calling banks in your file, your clients, and say, we want to buy your treasury bills. And maybe, you know, a smart bank's going to say, no, I think I'll keep my treasury bills. So you say, well, what if I raise the price? Okay. See, they'll play, and they'll push the price of those T-bills up, pushing the rates down. As the price goes up, he's going to send the banks more money, which goes into the federal funds pool, which will make the supply of money in the pool larger, which will also drive down the federal funds rate and therefore other bank rates as well. It's like an interlocking system. And it's just like, it's like an oiled machine that never quits. 24/7 around the world, these central banks are doing this. And to a large extent, they coordinate in certain sectors. Like the G7, we coordinate with our allies to maintain stability of the exchange rates between currencies. Because if one country sort of like made its interest rates higher, that would make its currency too strong against its allies' currencies. So we kind of work together, our feds do, so none of us go too far out of line. As a matter of fact, I teach, if you took my derivatives class, you would see how we use derivatives to hedge that currency exchange rate risk, what's left. We know that the countries try to maintain it, but we also know that countries that aren't part of our alliance are going to do whatever they want to do, like China. China for years would just printed money like there was no tomorrow, which made their products in the United States, at one point they were only about a third of what they would have been under purchasing power parity. That's staggering, but we didn't have an agreement with them. We just let them do it because we thought that they would become capitalists if we let them play that game, but it didn't work out that way. Okay, so this is the framework in which we operated. And we operate to this day. It is complex. I mean, you know, there are people who are at the top of this system who see the whole thing. It's just like they see all the transactions. They have it in their minds. But even at that, this is just an enormous amount of money. The problem is that we got into a thing where in the early 1950s, late 50s, we had a president named Dwight Eisenhower. Some people say the last of the moderate Republicans. He was a former general, and he was quite the boring kind of guy. The Republicans, when he started in office in mid-50s, they were screaming for a tax cut, which they're always crying for a tax cut. And he said, okay, I'll give it to you. Then after that, they kept screaming for more tax cuts. He said, shut up. I don't want to hear it. And then, of course, on the other side, the liberals were calling for more social welfare spending. And he said, no. The government is not in the business of coddling corporations, and it's not in the business of making the poor comfortable in their lot instead of having them go to work. Like kind of a harsh moderate, but the economy grew at a stable rate through his administration. And his last speech before Congress as he left office, that was the famous one where he said, beware of the military-industrial complex. He did not like the idea of a marriage of the government and industry, especially a marriage of the government and the industry through military adventurism. This is from a general, a very good general. The election that year in 1960 saw his vice president, a hardcore conservative right-winger, against a newfangled kind of Democrat. The one who wanted, was vice president under Eisenhower, his name was Richard Milhouse Nixon. And the guy against him was this Irish Catholic war hero for World War II named John F. Kennedy. And it came down to which way we were going to go with the country. Old Nixon, tax cuts as far as the eye can see, business is best, and poverty is the fault of the people who are in poverty. And you had Jack Kennedy. He was consummate. He knew all of the famous movie stars and singers. He hung out with Sinatra. There's stories about him and this girl named Marilyn, formerly Norma Jean. But he was quite a man. And so they had the first televised, and I saw it, first televised debate. And the, back then, I mean, black and white, these extremely powerful hot lights to get everything enough illuminated enough. And there was poor Richard Nixon, hunched over. What the hell's going on? And he looked like a ghoul, shadows hanging across his face. And there was Jack Kennedy just walking out there. He knew this camera. And he just ate Nixon alive. And Camelot was born. And he came forward. He said, no, we're going to spend money. We are going to put a man on the moon by the end of this century. Of course, the rocket scientists were saying, yeah, sure, Jack, you're not kidding. And all that kind of stuff. Advisors. He hated communists. God, he hated communists. He was going to put advisors in this godforsaken place in Southeast Asia called Vietnam. And he was going to talk about getting poverty under control. And Civil Rights Act, of all things. A Civil Rights Act? His vice president, Lyndon Johnson, was an old blue dog Democrat. God must have turned him over in his grave. But Kennedy was the man. His wife, Jackie, even took people on a tour of the White House. She was wearing Parisian clothes, and the hairdo was just second to none. And Jack Kennedy was running Camelot until that day in early November of 1963. Of course, I heard it was a lone gunman, but that was the end of it. And then Johnson took over. And if you need to leave, go ahead. I'm going to finish this story. I'll be done at the end of the class at 15 after. Johnson didn't like what was about to happen to him, but he became president, and everyone was just pleased. Because the old blue dog Democrat, he wasn't going to let any of these liberal policies get through. And unfortunately, he did. Because that's what Jack wanted. But unfortunately, that was printing money. Lots of money. And then from there, there was more money being printed. When Richard Nixon took over in 1968... the OPEC oil embargo, the Arabs got pissed at us because we were supporting Israel, so they shut off our oil. Prices went through the roof. And so Nixon put wage and price controls on. And then the Fed started printing money to try to absorb the shock of the price increases. And the money kept getting printed and printed. And then when Nixon resigned, his vice president, Gerald R. Ford, his idea of how to stop the inflation was to have millions of buttons printed. When? Whip inflation now. And so from there, he lost to a peanut farmer who was also a nuclear physicist named Jimmy Carter. A religious man, but a liberal. And Jimmy Carter saw this as what he called the moral equivalent of war. We will just say no to wage increases. We will say no to price increases. The moral equivalent of war, M-E-O-W, meow. Well, Carter wasn't an idiot. He knew what was going on. So he appointed in 1979. You see, what was happening was that the risk-free rate, the real rate, the Fed was trying to drive down. But the expected inflation premium was kept going up. And so you had this spiral of an inflate of risk-free rate getting progressively higher, that stagnation, and you had increasing inflation. So you had stagflation. Carter said, to hell with it. He appointed in 1979 an absolute ass of a man
Paul Volcker, V-O-L-K-E-R, to run the Fed. Volcker didn't care. Now, the market said, bullshit, you're not going to do anything. And Volcker said, watch me. He started to crush the money supply, which brought the real interest rates through the roof. But the markets didn't believe he was real. So they kept pushing the expected inflation premium up. So the risk-free rate and all rates on top of it went through the roof. We had mortgage rates at 25, 30%. And Carter went into the election of 1980 against a former governor of California who was also an actor in Western cowboy movies named Ronald Wilson Reagan. And Reagan just ate him alive. Well, you know, if I were president, I wouldn't have caused the economy to be destroyed. Oh, shut up, Ronald. You knew better. But Carter threw himself on the sword. He knew what had to be done. And it was just going to have to be done. Volcker did it, and he kept his hand on the throat of the economy. Into 1981, 82, the Congress passed a tax cut to try to get things going again, but Volcker was not going to let up on the money supply until the markets stopped putting the expected inflation premium in there. Do you believe me? No. Do you believe me? Fall. Do you believe me? Oh, yes, you're my daddy. Finally, the interest rate started sliding down. So Reagan comes out looking like a hero. Guess what? We're right there again. And it'll probably be 2024 when the idiot in the White House this time is going to do the same thing. He'll have to. There's no way to stop this because we're already getting the inflation, and that's when the cancer sets in, the expected inflation premium. Stay tuned for the ride. Thank you. That's all I have for you.